ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There was a chook who was left something like £10 million in a will. She was called Jiju, but she was rich, so maybe posh, like Jiju. Anyway, does that mean I can leave my car to my cat or my daddo to my dog? What the Duck is presenting Nature's Most Wanted, the intersection of animals and the law. You know, pigs being tried for murder or ducks getting speeding tickets. What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Failure. It's a part of life, whether we like it or not. So if, or inevitably when we fail, what should we do with it? How might we respond? Today on Big Ideas, an extraordinary story of failure and eventual extraordinary success from Miles Franklin award-winning novelist Siang Liu.
Six years represented to no published output. Three manuscripts never published. An entire career's worth of failure before I had even begun. Three manuscripts, 200 rejections, actually more, but who wants to brag? 6 years, trying, failing greatly.
Oh my God, more than 200 rejections, the tenacity, right? Hello, Natasha Mitchell with you. Welcome to Big Ideas. Every no brings us closer to a yes, said one motivational speaker. Yeah, right. I mean, some people, of course, success never comes for them. So let's lean into failure today and its life lessons with the Brisbane-based writer Siang Liu, who after years of struggle eventually published his first novel, The Whitewash, in 2022, a black comedy about the whitewashing of the Asian film industry. And then in 2024 came his follow-up, Ghost Cities, which took out Australia's most prestigious literary award last year, described by the Miles Franklin judging panel as at once a grand farce and a haunting meditation on diaspora. It's about a young man who is fired from his job as a Chinese translator when it's discovered he doesn't speak a word of Chinese and he has instead been using Google Translate. Siang is also co-creator of the Beige Index, which is an online movie review site that rates racial diversity in popular movies. And he joins you on Big Ideas today, reflecting on his failures in this hilariously deadpan 2025 E.W. Cole lecture at the Wheeler Centre for Books and Ideas on Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung Country in Naarm, Melbourne.
That's a lot of people. Hello. To paraphrase the late, great Mitch Hedberg, I used to hate doing speeches. I still do, but I used to too. So after the Wheeler Center people reached out to me to see if I would do a keynote, after I said yes and offered the topic of failure, and they said yes. In recent weeks leading up to this event, I would joke to them and say, hey, how funny would it be if I failed to show up to the keynote on failure, but still charged you for the event? They did not find this funny. So I have failed to be funny. And in actually having shown up tonight, I failed to fail. But let's get into it. The following is an email from the renowned New York publishing house, Alfred A. Knopf, written by Gary Fiskerjohn, the legendary editor of Cormac McCarthy, Donna Tartt, Bret Easton Ellis, Tobias Wolff, Haruki Murakami, and Peter Carey. Dear Redacted, several colleagues have joined me in reading this manuscript, and to tell you the truth, it got lost in the shuffle in that process, which might explain, but doesn't excuse this grotesquely tardy response. And sadly, my initial fears weren't far afield, even after all this time. Namely, that my long involvement with Haruki Murakami robs from Siang Liu's novel much of the surprise and delight and passionate conviction his rightful editor should offer eagerly and far more promptly. I hope, of course, you've heard that exact response elsewhere by now. Sincerely yours, Gary. We received this email 451 days after my manuscript went on submission to trade publishers in the United States in the years 2016 to 2019. I hope you've heard that exact response elsewhere by now. We had not. And if you're wondering, like I did for a very long time, thanks to his laconic and imprecise prose style, what Mr. Fisker John means when he references his, quote, long involvement with Haruki Murakami robbing from the manuscripts much of the surprise and delight and passionate conviction another editor should offer eagerly and far more promptly actually means. Don't worry, I decoded it for you. I had all the time in the world to decode it. Some days it stung, and other days it made me laugh. What he meant, essentially, although not necessarily unkindly, was, I have the real Murakami. So why would I need you? And it's a fair point. Sometimes you're preparing a keynote and you look back over memory and the materials in your inbox from years ago, and you're turned over and over into a pillar of salt. The trick is to figure out how not to become salty, to manage your transformation with grace. Mr. Fisker John's rejection was one of the final ones in the oft-quoted 200 rejections that have become synonymous with Ghost Cities and my name. I am, by the way, proud that this book is associated with failure on a grand scale. It's a rare book, I reckon, which changes its author's life in as many ways as this book did and continues to change mine. 200 rejections, comprised of about a dozen local literary agents who said no thanks, representing, I believe, every Australian agency at the time. Then 130 US literary agents who turned me down, and in amongst which I received 5 offers of representation and accepted one. And then from the years 2016 to 2019, roughly 40 US trade publishers who each in their turn said no. And I'm grateful for every single rejection. I wasn't at the time. What I wanted at the time was for the correct sequence of persons to have said yes. What the market was saying, essentially, though not necessarily unkindly, was we have plenty of books of whose value we are reasonably sure in a market that is saturated, moreover small, moreover notoriously difficult to predict. So why would we need your weird one? When you live amidst constant rejection, you have no choice but to be entirely changed by it. But you can choose how to be changed. You can choose to be bitter and resigned, or you can make a choice to go the opposite and find strength somewhere in all that mess. What these rejections taught me in aggregate, eventually, though the lessons took me years to understand, was that the assessment of worth comes from within. As creatives, we often finish our books unsure of them and are reliant on external persons to tell us that what we have written has value. That's all well and good. It's part of the process. But sometimes we forget the internal part. How to determine for ourselves whether what we have done has value. It takes practice. The Zen koan of it all is that before you can get an advocate, you must work out how to be your own advocate. This is the path to resilience. True, it's a tricky thing to learn surrounded by failure, but I reckon it might in fact be trickier to learn resilience surrounded by success. In the latter scenario, you might find you don't need resilience at all. Who needs resilience when times are good? Until, of course, the moment comes, inevitably, when times are bad. In retrospect, it has been nicer to have learned the harder lessons before I was published. Well, nice is not the right word. The lessons were horrible. but they were necessary, and I am stronger for them, and grateful. The we I referred to above in that letter is me and my then US agent, who represented me between the years 2015 and 2021. By 2019, we had shelved the manuscript that became Go Cities, I thought, forever. And I had completed my second novel, titled The Whitewash, which A, advocates for more and better Asian representation in the media, B, is perhaps the most factually comprehensive look at the history of whitewashing ever written in the form of a novel, C, is a comedy funnier in my estimation than Miles Franklin winning book, but D, is secretly, above all, a novel I wrote to process the failure of Go Cities. I cut 5 minutes from this speech when I learned a few weeks ago that it would be recorded and that it would be later broadcast on ABC's Big Ideas. The cut portion had to do with the manner of the painful parting of ways between myself and then US agent. I guess, though, there are some secrets I don't mind telling a room full of strangers, but broadcasting these to a nation full of them is maybe a different equation. You'll just have to make do with these facts. 6 years represented to no published output. 3 manuscripts never published. An entire career's worth of failure before I had even begun. And then, for reasons I would have said if this wasn't recorded, but won't say now because it is, I parted ways with that agent. 3 manuscripts, 200 rejections, actually more, but who wants to brag? 6 years, trying, failing, failing greatly. Slowly coming to terms that I was further than ever from my dream of publishing a book, further than when I started, actually, and might never in fact publish. But the gift and the lesson, the hard lesson, was that I had finally learned how to be my own advocate. I had clung for too long to the life raft of someone else's promised advocacy, which did not fit the shape of my own. I was lucky to then have won the Glendower Award for an unpublished manuscript at the Queensland Literary Awards, which allowed The Whitewash to be published. It won the ARBIA for the Audiobook of the Year in 2023, for its multicast audio adaptation starring 14 voice actors, 11 of which have Asian ethnicity. I am one of them. I have one line reading, which lasts 5 seconds, and that's it. But it has allowed me to say, with more or less a straight face, that in addition to being an award-winning writer, I am also an award-winning actor. It's impossible for me to talk about Go Cities without talking about The Whitewash. They are brothers to each other. The failure of Go Cities is what caused me to write The Whitewash, to code the pain of my first book's failure into the secret DNA of the second one. And it was the modest success of The Whitewash which gave me just enough of a toehold in the industry to sell Go Cities as more or less a new book, with my Australian agent, Brendan Fredericks, unburdened by the secret history of its failures. It is correct that they exist side by side, only with the strange circumstance that the second came first and the first second. And it's my hope, if you end up reading Go Cities and enjoying it, or have read it and have enjoyed it, that you seek out The Whitewash, if only to better regard how weird and strange and tenuous and wondrous and fraught a journey the creative career can sometimes be. One book does not exist without the other, and I have no career at all without my determination, when all evidence accrued over the years pointed to the idea that I should simply give up. With your indulgence, I'd like to quote from The Whitewash. The Whitewash tells the fictional tale of a Hollywood-China co-production, a AAA blockbuster spy film a la James Bond or Mission Impossible, but starring for the first time in Hollywood history an Asian male lead, to be played by protagonist J.K. Jr., who is described as not the smartest tool in the shed, but definitely the hottest, before he gets whitewashed out of the role. The real heart of the book, though, to me, belongs to his on-again, off-again girlfriend, Angela Moo, an actor who's had her ups and downs in the industry and finds unexpected success as a streamer when she accidentally falls asleep on stream and becomes known the world over as Snoring Beauty. I played her snores on the audiobook. They were award-winning snores. Much as all of the above is a completely outrageous set of scenarios, sometimes it is in the outrageous that you, the creator, can hide most plainly. To quote Angela, "I think I waited too long for my success, depended too much on it, put too much of myself into it, the idea of it, and it never came. Not really. So part of myself went away." Is that sick? Can I survive year after year of telling myself, "You got this, and keep going, and you'll get there"? I try to think positively. I say to myself, "Okay, you're going to get your big break by your birthday." And my birthday passes, and no big break. And I will say, "Okay, you'll get your big break by Christmas." And that passes too. This must sound petty to you, but my heart was breaking slowly because everything was passing me by. Everyone I knew was becoming successful. And this also from Angela later in the book. "I've never told anyone this, but I remember every role I've auditioned for and failed to get. Over 400. Yes, I gave her double my rejections. You might think I'm crazy, but I can recite them for you in perfect order. From 2005 till now, it's like I have this mental wall where I pin the rejections. You develop a tough skin. You have to make it in acting. And you find weird ways to trick yourself into feeling fine. I just didn't know if I could go back and face all that rejection again. But if not acting, then what? That's all I could think of while I was on stream. So I lost even more sleep. It was a vicious cycle. It got harder and harder after each rejection, after each nasty comment I read online. And suddenly, I figured out why I was feeling this way. See, I'd been waiting for success to solve everything, so I could turn to that giant wall of failure and negativity and say, this all finally makes sense. These were the challenges I had to overcome in order to make it. But I haven't succeeded. And I might never succeed. And that's when I realized maybe I need to look at things in a different way, because that wall is here to stay. Don't get me wrong, I'm never going to give up, never going to stop striving, but I can't only be okay with failure after I succeed. I have to find a way for it to make sense to me now, otherwise it won't mean anything when I do succeed." What to do when the work you put your heart and soul into must be shelved? One way is to channel those feelings into the next work. Find yourself on the page. In the end, invisibly, or visibly if you so wish to share, your works will become the map of your own journey. It's not a coincidence that life imitates art and vice versa. They are the map to each other. And now again, so indulgence. I'm going to read an excerpt from my Miles Franklin acceptance speech, which inspired the topic of today's keynote. And only you in this audience will have the clearest context given what I've mentioned above. So don't tell anyone. This is just between us and ABC Radio National, I guess. This book, Ghost Cities, was completed 10 years ago in 2015. It was the same book then, give or take, as it is now. At the time, no literary agency in Australia wanted it. All told, this book has been rejected over 200 times, both in Australia and abroad, where I was represented for 6 years by an American agent, during which time this manuscript and two additional manuscripts I produced did not sell. And then we parted ways, with me still not a published author. 6 years. confused as to how it had not worked out for me, unsure if I would continue. I used to print my rejections and blue tack them on the glass pane between my office and my bedroom. My youngest child, Madeline, had just been born. She is 9 now, and she would nap on that big bed while I worked and kept an eye on her. And the rejections kept piling up. Eventually, they grew so numerous that I could no longer see through the glass into the bedroom where my daughter slept. This was a hard moment for me, because if things continued in this manner and without a change in perspective, I would quite literally lose sight of the important thing. This book and its difficult journey into being taught me how to be a man, because I finally understood in that moment how to make sense of my failures. Not in retrospect, a decade later, delivered from the safety of the stage, having won the big award, but only right in that moment, looking through the glass at my daughter, at myself, when I decided I would continue writing, because to not write would be worse. We love to hear stories of failure, but only from people who have become successful. And I wish that That's Young, from that moment, could speak in front of you instead of me, because it would mean more, I think, to hear it from him wholeheartedly, having earned the difficult wisdom that one must accept failure, embrace failure, make a friend of it. We are fools for art, but I'm glad to have been a fool, to have persisted in my foolishness. I'm still a fool today. And if I'm perfectly honest with you, I fear success more than I do failure. I have not figured out how to embrace success, how to be its friend. The Miles Franklin Literary Award is a gift that is so meaningful to me as to be currently beyond meaning, beyond words, and I suspect it will take me the rest of my life to reckon with what it has all meant. So, 4 months on, and I'm still working it out. So the keynote on success will have to wait till the Wheeler Center invite me back someday. I might never know how to deliver that keynote, the keynote on success, but I do admit I am the right person to deliver the failure keynote.
Making Peace with Failure, the writer Siyoung Liu, author of Ghost Cities and The Whitewash. He joins you on Big Ideas here on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Siyoung is delivering his E.W. Cole lecture at Melbourne's Wheeler Centre, reflecting on his epic journey to publication and eventually a Miles Franklin Prize, helped by a little advice from sales and sports people.
Deep in the doldrums of uncertainty, circa 2014 to 2019, I remember trolling websites to seek out the worst horror stories that writers had to offer. The more unpublished they were, and the more agonizingly close they got to the publishing dream, and paradoxically further from it, the better. This was a tiny bit helpful in making me feel slightly less alone on the bell curve of bad luck, but also at the same time extremely unhelpful in terms of consequential actionable outcomes. What are you supposed to do with the information that other people's journeys have been just as hard, other than to feel slightly better and then feel bad about feeling better? So, consuming horror stories from fellow unpublished writers, a little helpful, not very helpful. Neither was it very useful hearing from successful writers, and you should therefore take a grain of salt in listening to me. It's probably useless you're listening to me. In fact, you should maybe request a refund for your ticket tonight. Talk to the Wheeler people, they'll sort you out. Because a person's success colours all their failures. Maddeningly, it converts past failures into successes. So you must not listen to me either. What you want to do is learn from people for whom failure is a daily occurrence. The more commonplace, the better. Who to learn from? Salespeople and sports people. I did. So what did I learn from salespeople? A technique called go to know. As a sales principle, it went a little bit like this. Let's say, for argument's sake, a car salesman might, on average, need to speak with 9 people on the lot before finally making a sale with the 10th. I made that up, by the way. A salesperson sufficiently acquainted with the process of how to do their job will understand, therefore, that failure is just part of the process, and accordingly, a shift in mindset. Instead of chasing yes, chase no. Shift the target from making 1 sale a week, the original goal, to instead approaching 10 customers with your best foot forward, understanding that 9 will say no, maybe even 10. The number remains the same, 1 sale, but the goal is different. Due to a shift in perspective, success becomes a byproduct, a side effect of believing in the process. In other words, chasing no makes yes inevitable. I want to pause there for a second, because that sounds good, but if you think about it a little bit, you might start to see the flaws. What if you keep chasing no's and never see a yes? How do you stay positive if it's always a no? What if there's something wrong with your process and there is no yes? What if everyone says no? These are good questions. So if you think about it a little bit, flaws are plenty. But I want to guarantee you, if you think about it more than a little bit, think about it a lot, there are no flaws, 0 flaws. Because the goal is not to be published. The goal is to grow, to get better. At what? At everything. The writing journey is about embracing the tricky paradoxes such as this. Here's another example of a paradox expressed in 2 conflicting truths. First truth, I will never be published. Second truth, it is inevitable that I will be published. The writer who can paradoxically embrace both of these truths at once will succeed in their publishing dream. Or to put it another way that helps my author brain tremendously, we often make the mistake of thinking about success and failure like this. Success over here, failure over here, and us in the middle, trying to lean towards success and away from failure. But the truth is that success is here, and we're here, and failure is right in the middle, waiting for us to get through it. My wife, unlike me, is a naturally resilient person. So what did I learn from my wife, whose advice to me every single time, though not necessarily unkindly, was, just don't worry about it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I learned nothing from my wife. Don't worry, she's not in the audience. Otherwise, I wouldn't be saying this. But Wheeler people and ABC Radio National people, do not send her the recording. Okay, what did I learn from sports people? A lot, actually. While doing research for The Whitewash, I got very invested in the world of mixed martial arts. It helped that the UFC was more or less the only thing going throughout COVID. And I came to see the fighter's plight as essentially something akin to the writer's plight, in the sense that you'd have to be a bit mad to do it in the first place. You step into the ring alone, ready to be bruised, battered, broken. Also, the pay sucks. And I was very taken by one fighter who was interviewed on the eve of his biggest fight in a rematch against an opponent who had brutally knocked him out years earlier. Asked whether he was worried about the upcoming fight, he responded, "No. Why would I be worried? I've done everything I could possibly do. If there was more to do, I would do it." If there was a mantra that could describe my approach to publishing, which you should not emulate, I do not recommend it. It does not leave very much room for an ordinary life. This would be it. If there was more to do, I would do it. I remember turning to my wife and saying, "I get it. I finally get what you mean." I then explained the idea. Work so hard for so long in every conceivable, imaginable sub-discipline, turn your pursuit of mastery on the page towards a mastery of the industry that shut you out. Pitching, design, PR, rights, marketing, social media. Become as good at all those things as you think you are a writer. My wife then responded, "Oh my God, that is not what I meant at all." But by then it was already too late. I was already seduced by that look of complete calm on that fighter's face. And he won the rematch, by the way, avenged his knockout loss. Not that it matters, truly, because in the alternate universe where he lost that rematch, he had already won. He believed in his process. And if there was more to do, he would have done it. And if it was a loss then awaiting him, he would have committed eventually to studying that too and learning from it. Once, after hearing me give a talk, an agent who was in the audience approached me and said, "You could be an agent." After spending time talking to me in a green room, a publicist once said, "You could be a publicist." An executive producer once said, "You could be a film executive." A rights manager, ditto. Why? Because if there was more to do, I would do it. Because having spent so much time on the outside of this industry, looking in, hoping to be invited through the front door, having instead to make do with a side door, leading to a side door, leading to another side door, leading eventually to the house. Having finally made it into the house, I looked around and said to myself, "Now that I'm here, I am one day going to own this place," and then open the door from within for others who need it. So don't be like me. But if you want some sane, actionable advice, sit down and draw two circles, an inner circle and an outer circle. Now think of everything you can influence and control, whether your manuscript is in good shape, your willingness to send it to publishers and agents, your willingness to interrogate your process and make adjustments accordingly, to keep writing, to write the next one, and the next one after that, regardless of the outcome. To workshop compelling one-sentence pitches that you're able to repeat word for word in your sleep. To commit to putting yourself in spaces, events, and opportunities where such pitches actually matter. Put all of those things inside the inner circle. Now think of everything you can't influence. How your manuscript is received by the industry professional. What value someone sees or doesn't see in it. Whether they are busy. Whether they are uninterested. If you're a published author, congratulations, there is still an outer circle. That contains things like how the book is reviewed, what the public thinks of it, whether the public thinks of it at all, how it sells, the festivals you're invited or not invited to. All those things go in the outer circle. Now look at the stuff in the inner circle. That's the stuff to focus on. Anything else exists in the outer circle. And as my wife so wisely says, just don't worry about it. There is a lot to learn from my wife and a lot to learn from sports people. How do champions of martial arts, of tennis, of rugby, of any sport, shrug off failure? A crucial point lost during a match, a dropped serve, a penalty conceded, and still maintain their focus and drive, not become distracted. Disheartened. They do not dwell. They are not burdened by past poor performance. To the extent that the past failures exist, they only exist as a means towards self-improvement, not self-flagellation. They live in the present. They visualize the future. The champion is destined to succeed because she or he has understood the mechanics of processing loss, learning from it, and the learning never stops. This is the mindset of a champion. And the final thing I'll say tonight is that there is a second meaning to the word champion, and it is just as important. Champion others. Learn so you can share, so you can find those who might need you, and champion them in their own strange crossings. Thank you.
What a wonderful and generous lesson for us all from the Miles Franklin award-winning Australian writer Siyang Liu. And thanks to his wife, maybe you too are suddenly inspired to make "Just Don't Worry About It" your new life mantra. That was the 2025 E.W. Cole Lecture from the Wheeler Centre for Books and Ideas. And this is Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell on ABC Radio National, on ABC Listen and as podcast. Now, Siang joins fellow novelist, best-selling author of Edition, last year's Tenderfoot and many more, Tony Jordan, in conversation.
Wow. I'm exhausted just thinking about all those rejections on your glass wall. I would like to start, Siang, with, I guess, the why. You've told us that the only thing worse than writing would be not writing, but there is an enormous amount of time and effort and hours that has gone into this process and an enormous amount of determination that has seen you through this. Why?
Why write?
Why write? Why keep going? Why want to be published? Why send out all those queries?
I really wish this part wasn't recorded so I could tell you the real truth. I'll tell you anyway. So a couple of weeks ago, I was at AusAsia Writers Festival and made the mistake of actually saying this on stage, which was, you know, this has been a really weird year for me and obviously a very personally satisfying one, tremendous one, an overwhelming one, with mostly good and a little bit not so good. But I guess in the whirlwind, which is properly a whirlwind, I think, I had sort of made a commitment to myself because of busyness to not write till the end of the year. And for a while that was good. It was kind of like a load lifted from my shoulders. A permission, you know, sort of given, you don't have to think about this stuff while you deal with other mountains. And then a couple months passed and I started getting really antsy. And I turned to my wife and I said, hey, you know, I think writers are maybe a little bit similar to serial killers. You know, like when you don't do the thing that you're supposed to do. Then all you do all day is just dream of the day when you can do the thing, right? And so I'm talking about writing now, not serial killing. And I guess that's sort of one way to answer your question, which is, you know, it's just a compulsion. We just have to.
I understand that part of it. I share that. I also find it.
Tony Jordan has admitted she's a serial killer.
That's
everyone.
Right. We're both serial killers. It's coming out now. I also feel like it's the way I process the world around me, sitting down and putting it on the page. But that doesn't necessitate getting it published. That doesn't necessitate having to share it with the world and wanting not just that, but traditional publishing, which is only one possible way of many for other people to read your work. So why was that the path that you were so determined to take?
I think childhood dreams can be very dangerous and damaging, right? Because you sort of picture your book on the shelves next to shoulder to shoulder with the works that inspired you to write them. And so I think that was just sort of the overriding fantasy for me.
So you had always wanted to be a writer since you were a child?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And that is something that you just, I guess, did not want to let go of. Did you write as a child? Are you one of these people who has bottom drawers full of stapled together novels from when you were 10 and 12?
I think I really started dreaming of it maybe when I was a child, but then in earnest writing when I was maybe 18 or 19. Mm-hmm. And again, the dangerous dream, which is you're so filled with hope and optimism and a serious lack of knowledge that you sort of pin your hopes to something that is completely unattainable. I remember reading somewhere that Michael Chabon had written his first book at 24, published his first book at 24.
Right. See, that's wrong, isn't it?
It's totally wrong. And what an injustice Michael Chabon has done to all of us. But you find some impossible dream and then you chase after it.
But you didn't. Like, that's not what you studied and that's not what your day job is. It's not like you threw all your cards in. You had the presence of mind to build another career.
Yeah, that's right. And I know that's a good question when I start panicking because I don't know how to answer that. You know, I was telling you in the green room that I think we were sort of talking, dancing around the idea of the possibility, the option for, I think everyone wants to think that this is possible, especially for a Miles Franklin winner,
yes.
whether or not you can quit your day job and sort of devote your full time to writing. And I currently haven't done that. I'm grateful for the option. And, you know, I told you that I've got two kids and they're in private school. So realistically, I have to write a lot more books and they have to be better than Go Cities or at least as good as. I think that's quite an unreasonable amount of pressure to put on someone who, if you really boil it down to what is important, why write and why put words on the page and, yes, why strive towards publication traditionally, it is so that you can say something valuable and perhaps hopefully touch the hearts and minds of the reader. And so I don't necessarily really like the idea of putting all the, you know, I don't know what the right analogy is, but like putting it all, going all in on writing. I've been famously risk averse. And I think perhaps as an artist that has been maybe to my detriment. I remember thinking, and I've said this before, but the opening epigraph to Ghost Cities reads, and what if after all this, it's a bad novel? And this is a quote from Mercedes Marquez, the wife of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I actually inserted this at the 11th hour. Wow. It was a different epigraph. And suddenly something moved me to kind of put this in. And it was a great gift to me because it really spoke my heart, which was, on one level, what if this is, after all, a bad novel, the novel you're about to read? But also it's allowed me to tell the story of Mercedes and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, which I love to tell and love to think about. And it sort of reminds me of why I do the thing and also reasons why I do other things as well. And so quite famously, this was in relation to the novel that became, the manuscript that became 100 Years of Solitude, without which Ghost Cities really would not exist. And Mercedes, they had a number of children. I can't remember how many, but the story goes that Marquez was sort of stocked up in his garret with cigarettes and coffee and food, and she would deliver them to him. And he was really there for like 18 months just working on his magnum opus and really sort of not doing much else in terms of family. She was keeping the family together and the household, and she would have to pawn off bits of cutlery and silverware in order to keep them afloat. And it was only halfway, it was on their way to the post office to post the manuscript that would either plunge them into mm-hmm. complete desperate poverty yep. because if he had wasted his time.
Everything is riding on that exactly. one manuscript.
And she turned to him, and she had not uttered a negative word to him in all the years prior, supporting him fully. She then said to him, and it's like the pillar of salt moment, Lot's wife, where at the last moment she sort of reveals her weakness, which I love, which is, what if after all this is a bad novel? And of course we know, because we live in the present, that it wasn't a bad novel. It is perhaps the greatest novel of all time. But what if it was, mm-hmm. right? And what if she'd spent all this time sort of supporting him? And, you know, I spent a lot of my younger years really idolizing Marquez and for his writing. And it's only really been in recent years that I've come instead to idolize and empathize with Mercedes. And so if that's where my heart lies, which is not completely an artist or not all in or not fully an artist, then that's okay.
We know by now, because you're on the other side of this successful, hugely successful run, that Ghost Cities is not a bad novel. It's a wonderful novel. It's my favourite novel I've read this year. And I read out the list of awards and prizes it has won so far. How do you then contextualise some of these responses that other people were giving you through these difficult years? Was it a timing thing? Were they had just not caught up with what you were doing? Has the world changed that this has revealed itself? Were they wrong in some other way? Or was it just about fitting into capitalist structures of publishing companies? What were they thinking, do you think, that they couldn't see this novel?
The last part of what you said is sort of on the wavelength. I tend to think, I'm only 4 months into it, so I really don't know. I will say that as you were asking this question, all I could think of was the day after having won the Miles Frankl or the award ceremony, you don't have time to celebrate because you have to get up really, really early for ABC TV.
Right.
You have to be coherent and not drunk or hungover. And they beam you in from, so the ceremony was in Sydney and the show is filmed live in Melbourne. So they're on the couch, the presenters, and you're sort of ushered into this tiny booth on a couch that looks like this. And there's someone who's like kind of fiddling with all sorts of audio equipment that they wrap around your ear and sort of make sure that you look presentable for camera. And then they say, don't look directly at this massive screen, which is all you can look at, because that's the feed that will show what is actually broadcasting live. Right. And what you have to look at is the big black abyss of the camera lens, which is frightening in its own way. And of course, I failed and I kind of glanced to look at the actual screen. And what's the name of the thing, the news ticker that goes across?
Yeah.
And it said, you know, Xiang Lu, Miles Franklin, Ghost Cities, and a very brief description of the book, which read part fable, part rom-com. And I was about to go live. It was 5 seconds from going live. I literally slapped my head and I said, ah, like, if I'd known to use those words, I wouldn't have spent 9 years trying to get the book published. So I tend to think it is more in the delivery. What I found is that publishers, and I don't want to impugn any publishers, they're wonderful and they're great advocates, but I've also found, let's say in abstract, that publishers are famously risk averse. They don't like hearing that your book is not like any other book out there. Instead, they love to hear how similar your book is to a super, super successful book. And it took me a really long time to figure that out. So when I describe Ghost Cities as being, in my speech, I said, figure out your one sentence pitch that you could recite in your sleep. Ghost Cities is about a young Chinese Australian man named Xiang, spelt with an X, so no relation to me, who works at the Chinese Sydney consulate as a translator when it's discovered that he's in fact monolingual, so he gets fired, and has been relying on Google Translate for all of his job. And so that's basically where I end. And the book is so much more than that.
Yes.
But I've learned over the years that that's the pitch. It's almost like the dark arts. It's almost like going to the dark side and figuring out like all the nasty things that you should and maybe should not, I'm not sure, sort of lie about your book in order to, it's like a Trojan horse, right? And the way I describe it is pitching, which is its own art form, which I happen to be really good at now. I wasn't early on. It's almost like figuring out what the clickbait line is, right? And you present them the line and they have no choice but to scratch. Mm-hmm. That's the curiosity. So it's a different art form. And the thing that I've realized is write the weird book, write your weird book. And once you're done writing it, if you want to be traditionally published, and you don't need to be, but if you want to be, then you've got to figure out how to fool publishers into taking it.
That is great advice. Now that you are where you are, you will almost certainly be running into some of these people again. How do you has that happened yet? How do you envisage that going?
There's so much of this I can't actually tell you. All right, okay, so I'll tell you at dinner. But before that, to answer your question in another way, yes, in fact. Now I remember it. There was an agent at the ceremony where I gave that speech, or a longer version of that speech, who came up to me afterwards and had evidently gone through their inbox.
Uh-oh.
Years and years worth, found my submission to them and came up to me and was so like profusively apologetic. I was going through a really weird time. It was difficult. And I just remember thinking, there's no need to apologize. This is not fake gratitude. I've spent a lot of time thinking about what all of this has been. And most of the thinking took place in a dark room where nobody was watching, right? And so I had to make my peace with this pretty early on. The fact is, that person rejected the manuscript, submission for the manuscript that became Ghost Cities, I think correctly, because I didn't know how to pitch it. And that's not to put all of the burden on me, but again, it's the inner circle, outer circle thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, you are at the mercy of the whims of publishers and what they think is publishable or not, but there is also something you can do, which is present them a compelling product. And I think I failed to do that early on.
I think that's very generous of you. Well, you are no longer an unpublished writer. You are a very successful award-winning writer. Is this what success looks like? Is this what you'd always imagined it would be?
So in my wildest dreams, I never wanted to be on a stage.
Your wildest dreams have failed.
They've failed. So I am correctly found the right theme for tonight. I just don't have the right brain chemistry to desire the spotlight. And that's a tricky thing when there is quite literally a spotlight on me. I knew this about myself. Obviously, you do. But I came to know it very intimately when my first book came out, because at the same time as being very introverted, I'm also extremely ambitious. And I think maybe one of the things that has been a saving grace has been that the ambition has outstripped the introversion, to the point where, you know, I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't try the thing. And the thing being, you know, trying to be a public person or doing the right thing, whatever the right thing might be. And what I was seeing or hearing about, because I was not on socials at the time, because I didn't know how to be authentic on socials, and I was scared of revealing myself ultimately. What I was hearing was that you should go into bookstores and announce yourself and tell them you are the author and can you sign a book?
Yikes.
And, you know, I did this a couple of times and I hated it. And I realized that just was not giving me the right endorphins. And so all of this, it's an exaggeration, it's a joke. There is joy here, I should say, and especially with you. But I am also kind of here under duress.
Well, I don't quite know what to say about that. We have loved having you, whether it's under duress or not. It's been a pleasure to host you this evening and to introduce you to some more readers. Please join with me in thanking Xiang Lu.
For anyone who has ever wanted to give up, that was Xiang Lu, author of Ghost Cities and The Whitewash. And asking the questions was fellow novelist Tony Jordan, whose books include last year's Tenderfoot and her 2008 international best-selling debut Edition, which was long listed for the Miles Franklin Award and has just been turned into a movie. I can't wait to see it. You can check out more great events from the Wheeler Centre via their website. They also have a podcast, as does Big Ideas, which you can find on ABC Listen or all the podcast apps except Spotify. To join me at a live event, search for Big Ideas and be in our audience, and you'll find it or look for that on our homepage. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Have a happy and a safe Easter. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.